Welcome to Newsworthy with Norisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show, friends. Today we have with us from Perth, Western Australia, Jared McKenna. Jared, how are you doing today, man?
I'm doing well, mate. How are you doing?
I'm good. I can't not make a joke about how you are actually one day ahead of me right now. I'm recording on a Monday. You're on a Tuesday. I feel like I'm doing time travel right now.
It's been said before that Australia is America's future. Isn't that a nice prayer?
Yeah, I mean, sure. I guess so.
Healthcare, gun laws, anybody can go to university if you get that. That sounds like a good future, right?
Yeah. You say that in Texas, you will get shot, but it's a great idea. Are you born and raised in Western Australia?
Born and bred, yeah. Neither mum nor dad are from Perth, but it's where I've grown up. My dad is actually he was born in Northern Ireland, and dad was actually a brother in a Catholic order.
Really?
Not still a brother, because no, I'm here.
He didn't do too good on that.
Yeah, but yeah, that's... So dad's right a migrant to Australia.
Well, isn't Perth right on the coast?
It is. It's a beautiful city. Most isolated capital city in the world. It looks like Sydney, but without the pace of Sydney. So, yeah, it's a lovely place to grow up. I was speaking in the US in 2010, and I found myself in LAX, and this elderly African-American woman came and sat down next to me and asked me the time, and I told her the time, and she said, "Are you British?" And I said, "No, I'm Australian." And she said, "What are you doing here?" And I told her that I was preaching, and she was over the moon. She thought that was wonderful, and we got talking, and she said, "Why would they invite you out?" And talked about the neighborhood we live in and that it's one of the roughest neighborhoods in our city. And she said, "Well, you must have, like, gang killings." And I said, "Yeah, we do." And she goes, "It must happen frequently." And I said, "Well, for where I'm from, yeah, it does." And she goes, how often has it happened?" And I said, "Well, the 8 years we've lived there, we've had two gang killings." And she said, "8 weeks." And I said, no, 8 years." And she said, "Here, that's a good neighborhood."
Yeah, that's a great neighborhood. Come on now.
Which just tells you a little bit of something of the difference. I can't imagine our neighborhoods with the reality of, how easily guns are available in the U.S. It would be a war zone. So I feel for you lot. And in all seriousness, do pray for you. It's pretty full on over there.
Yeah, it's definitely a different world. And also, in the background, I hear, like, nature and animals and birds, and I'm sure that was a kangaroo as well. There's none of that in the background for my house.
Right. Yeah, you can probably hear the chickens, and there's even some kookaburras and some other birds. I'm working from home today, first home project, so it's beautiful.
Okay, let's talk about that first home project. So you live with, like, a dozen plus refugees along with your wife and your kid?
Yeah. Teresa, Tice, and I, and a mate, Alan, who's come back from Mozambique, where he was part of grassroots mission work there. He's come back and moved in with us. And so, first home project, one of the things about Australia that isn't very utopian and is actually pretty horrific is how we treat asylum seekers. Australians find it pretty easy to have a go at America's history of racism. But Australia has a black history, and I mean that in both respects. Apartheid was actually designed on policies that came from Western Australia, which a lot of people don't know. So Australia had, right up until the late 60s, something they called White Australia Policy, which basically, since Federation in 1901, didn't allow people who were anything other than British up until the 50s to be a part of Australia. So our treatment of asylum seekers or refugees today is still pretty disgusting. And currently, as we're talking, Luke, there is over 600 children who are indefinitely detained, as well as their families, in offshore detention. So
that's terrible. When you're saying refugees, where are these people coming from?
Basically everywhere we're waging war. So Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran. So they often come via Pakistan and will make their way to Indonesia, and then if they're able to get on a boat to come to Australia. But as well as Somalia and parts of West Africa as well.
So there are hundreds of these kids, and your first home project, are you bringing kids that are detained into your camp, your house?
It's actually the detention centers actually function as prisons, and they're actually run by international corporations that run prisons as well. Places like Transcorp, and that's a recent evolution in Australia's history in terms of relating to asylum seekers as well. So what we provide at First Home Project is, once people are actually processed and released into the community, in Western Australia, we have a mining boom. That means that our economy has been booming more than China. So there's huge inflation in terms of house prices, which means that if you're arriving in Australia and you've got complex post-traumatic stress disorder and family in refugee camps, maybe in Indonesia or on Christmas Island or Nauru, or back in places like Pakistan or Afghanistan, you're dealing with that and you're trying to learn the language and you can't get into the rental market. So even for young professionals, it's very difficult if you've got a cat to get a rental property, how much more so for these people who are arriving with nothing. So what First Home Project offers is a place for people to find a feet, to find their feet, to develop a rental history. We talk about it, Luke, as not a handout, but a hand up. One of the redemptive qualities of the Australian ethos is, in the same way that America has as its heartbeat freedom, our equivalent word would actually be fair go. And fair go is maybe a little bit more earthy and less, I don't know, abstract understanding of justice. It's that everybody deserves a fair go. Everybody, and that, more than freedom for the Australian, is what makes our psyche tick. And so what First Home Project is seeking to do, if we were to apply Australianese to what is something that reflects the kingdom, we're seeking to give these people a fair go. So we've seen over 27 people in the last 2 years since starting First Home Project move from secondary homelessness to being able to enter the rental market. And one of the families who have graduated from being with us actually now own their own home, which is an amazing success story. So that's the joy of our life. It's these amazing people that have been through so much. We have the privilege of living alongside and just being good neighbors.
Yeah, that sounds outstanding. Okay, I love the idea. It sounds like those are a great way to be faithful to the talents and the giftings and the resources you have. Definitely an at-risk group of people that need the assistance, that you get a great opportunity to help them out. Sounds like a great program. But you actually live with them? I mean, I love people and all that, but I don't want them in my house at night. Okay, is it like same living room, same kitchen, bathroom, all that stuff you're sharing?
Yeah, good question. So compared to the community I first started when I returned from, I did some of my studying in the States, and while there I lived with Carl Meyer, and that was my first experience of living in a Catholic worker house. Carl is this amazing dude in Nashville. I lived in East Nashville with him, where at the time it wasn't hipsterdom. We were the one of two white people within eight blocks. And Carl had this photo in his living room of him marching shoulder to shoulder with Thich Nhat Hanh on one shoulder and Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King on the other. And Carl headed up the Catholic Worker in Chicago. So the photo's from like 67, which was some of the most violent responses to the freedom movement was actually in the North, in places like Chicago. And so I came back and with some other people, we started praying, and we started an Anabaptist Catholic worker in one of the roughest neighbourhoods in our city, where we started a permaculture community garden, and we practiced hospitality for people who were homeless. It's then that I first started visiting refugees in these prisons that we call detention centres. Prisoners actually have a higher standard of living after years of running workshops in prisons. What I've seen in detention centres actually falls below maximum security prisons that I've worked in here running non-violence workshops. And so compared to that and our previous work, what we're doing now seems a walk in the park, actually.
Really?
So we bought a place that is big enough that we were able to subdivide it three ways. And what it means is that the families, so we have one family from Afghanistan, and we have another household which... four young guys who are Hazara, so a minority group, Shia minority group, who are being targeted by the Taliban as well, and they're in the other house with Alan. And so we share meals together, and Alan lives in one of the houses with these four young guys who are actually still in high school. They've been released from detention and are now in high schools here. So... yeah, we don't share in the same way we used to, where literally we had, you know, homeless people who were sleeping in, you know, the room next door. Yeah. We've far more privacy now. But that said, we do live together all the time. One of the most fun things is things like Razi, who's in his 50s, who escaped the Taliban, teaching him to skateboard. So we do. Have you ever seen tarp surfing?
You know, I saw you posted something about that. Didn't you post it on Twitter not too long ago?
Yeah. So we do things like tarp surfing, which is the best fun ever. So it's things like that which are, for us, little signs of God's world breaking in. Tarp surfing and...
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
Long and, yeah.
Okay, so you have this great thing you're part of, and you have dreadlocks. And so people say that you're like the Australian Shane Claiborne. Are you guys, you know, long lost best friends, just separated at birth or something?
Shane's a wonderful fella, and
Guys know each other?
Yeah.
Of course you do. How do you not know him?
We've spoken at things over the years. I think we first spoke together in 2009 or something. So we've keynoted a number of things together, both in Asia and here in Australia and in the US a couple of times. So. Yeah, I mean, Shane's a legend. And we share, in the same way that Catholicism is an influence on Shane, Eastern Orthodoxy is probably an influence on me. We both share that Catholic worker influence, but I would probably be a little bit more Anabaptist in my ecclesiology. Mm-hmm. But... yeah, I mean, Shane's a ledge in the space that he's... This is the thing that impresses me about Shane, is that, you know, us white, straight males, who it's very easy, if you want to end up on a circuit and make a lot of money doing that and end up in this little Christian bubble. And yet Shane continues to live where he lives, continues to make space for all those that have been excluded from those places. And they're the things that really impress me about Brother Shane, is that he's the real deal. And in doing so, you actually start to subvert the culture of celebrity, which in Christian circles is just so unhealthy and so counter to discipleship. And actually, in fact... is so much worse in the US because there's such a bigger market for it, I guess. One of the gifts, I think, Luke, of actually living in Australia is that Australians don't care what you say. They want to see what you do. And, you know, only 8-9% of Australians are regular church attending. 2% of Australians are regular mosque attending. And they're the two biggest, like, religious groups. So Australia is deeply secular. Mm-hmm. but not in a negative way. It's the beautiful reality of no one goes to church, unlike Texas, unless you want to follow Jesus. And that in itself, like it doesn't work to your advantage to go to church in terms of getting a job or how you're perceived in the community. Or so that I think it would be great for the good of missions in the U.S. if missionaries came and spent some time in a post-Christian setting, because a lot of stuff that happens in the U.S. is Christians looking sideways to other Christians instead of actually finding themselves amongst those who our friends who have come to Christ this last year. It's people who have got like zero understanding, and their initial education about Jesus comes via South Park, not through the scriptures.
Was that South Park? That's good. Was that your experience when you were in Nashville? All right, first of all, how long were you in Nashville when you were studying?
I lasted a year.
Where were you studying?
I was at Lipscomb University with Dr. Lee Camp. So Lee was a mentor and my professor for biblical ethics.
That's outstanding. I went to Abilene Christian University, which is a fellow Church of Christ school, yeah.
Check you out. Wow. Yeah. So, yeah, I experienced something of that world, which I really did experience culture shock in the U.S. It's just so different. I had an easier time being in Southeast Asia or being in Zambia than it was like this weird parallel universe.
What was the hardest part of that parallel universe?
Oh wow! I don't think I've ever talked about this like semi-publicly. It's the illusion of privacy in
No podcast. One's listening. Don't worry about it.
That's right. So I was there during September 11th, and things became quite strained with a number of friends, including the host family I was with, and had to move on. I think the Australian was quaint before September 11th, and then offensive afterwards.
What do you mean offensive?
So saying things like, isn't this an issue of international law? Surely as Christians, we need to actually be pioneering a response that looks like restorative justice and forgiveness. Surely when Jesus says, love your enemies, he probably means don't bomb them. And it's stuff like that, which as an Aussie, that's the pushback you have from people who aren't Christians all the time, is like, to use Gandhi's words, I like your Christ, but not you Christians. You Christians are nothing like your Christ. And being in the States where there's so much cultural Christianity, and it's the bumper stickers that it's like, save the drama for Osama next to God bless America. And it's just like, I'm not sure what God we're praying to when those things fit comfortably together. Certainly not the crucified and resurrected one who taught us to love our enemies. Yes. So it's things like that that made... I had this experience. A friend who lived in Memphis, and I think at university it was popular for, as the Australian, people would bring you back on the weekends and introduce you to their home church and their family. That was fun because it's like, oh, look, here's my token Australian friend. And it was a university student's Bible study before the main worship service, and there were a couple of hundred people in there, and this is a week, 2 weeks after September 11th, and they're teaching on Romans 13. And I just raised my hand during the Bible study and just said, how does this fit with the rest of Romans 13 and what comes before it in Romans 12? And to the credit of the guy who was actually taking the Bible study, he engaged me and actually invited me up front, and the rest of the time was actually engaging around that, and we prayed for each other. But my friend who had actually invited me, afterwards, after people left, he grabbed me by the shirt and pushed me against the wall, and he was about 6'4", and height isn't my gift to the world. And And he just pointed at me while holding my shirt with his fist, with his elbow against my chest, and he said, "Don't you ever do that to me again." And it was just one of those cultural moments where I didn't realize that me kind of raising these questions was so culturally insensitive that I'd actually shamed him in front of his home community, which wasn't my intention at all. But it was things like that, just like, well, to use an Americanism, I don't think I'm in... I can't even remember. It was a modest quote.
The what quote?
Toto, I don't think we're in Kansas anymore.
Oh, yeah. We're not in Kansas anymore. Yeah, I got that.
So it's like, Jared, we're not in Australia anymore.
Okay, so tell me how that would have been received in Australia if you say that post 9/11. Obviously, we're assuming that something happened to Australia, and you raise your hand, you have that kind of comment in Australia. How does that go compared to what happened in Memphis?
Well, like, I grew up like in the community I came to faith in, even though it was conservative, you wouldn't have any Christians who thought that, Christians should be able to carry guns and stuff like that. It's just a given culturally that's... Like, I'm pausing because I know you're from Texas, but an Australian would just say, that's crazy. Like, why do you need... and I understand people hunt and I have many more, but I'm like, if it's a sport, like, you know, strap a high-powered rifle on the back of the deer and let them, like, be able to fire back. That's that's more of a game, right? Like, that's probably disingenuous. But it just, it's the cultural, just how, like, and people would say, oh, so you're liberal. To understand the Australian context, the Liberal Party is our, centre-right party, the equivalent of the Republican Party. So Obama is actually more conservative than our current Australian Conservative government on a number of issues, like including we would never see the reintroduction of the death penalty. That ended in Australia, was it 72? There's a number of things that just don't... but also in the American context, like... I think it's interesting as an outsider that people often forget that Richard Nixon economically was more progressive as a Republican than what Obama is currently now. But things are so... People are so caught up in the culture wars that to step back and have kind of rational conversations based in history is very difficult in the States. Man, this whole conversation took a turn that...
that's all right.
I'm probably going to kill your podcast, right?
Yeah, you probably are, but that's okay. Yeah. I've had a good run. It's been good while it lasted.
Now we're just going to counsel Jared as he debriefs his experience of living in the U.S. as an Australian.
Yeah, definitely. Well, first of all, I want you to know, I hope you enjoyed your time to Texas that you might have had in the past because you're never invited back. So that's all right. You can watch... Watch some old Friday Night Lights episodes, and you'll be caught up on what Texas is like if you didn't get to your first time there. But you spend a lot of time in the States. The way I actually got to know you by internet stuff is that I saw your friends with Ian Cron, who's been on the show a couple times. Your friends with Nadia, and then BZ actually Brian Zahn, who's on 2 weeks ago. He said I should have you on. I thought, oh yeah, I've seen the guy with dreadlocks. We need to have him on. So you,
God, yeah, Brian and Perry, they were staying with us just a couple of weeks back, probably 3 weeks back. They were down here visiting us, which was awesome.
So you were who he was visiting down in Australia. Yeah, okay, that makes sense. So how did you get to know some of these people in the United States? Obviously, you've been here a lot, right?
No, not a whole heap. And in fact, there was 6 years or so that I didn't get on planes at all.
Is that because you got blacklisted after your post 9/11 comments?
No, that's a lights thing on my record, mate. It was actually, given our unprecedented ecological crisis, at the time, I think I was much more in a Christian anarchist kind of vein of seeking to... to paraphrase a misquote from Gandhi, to be the change you want to see, that we're trying to embody something. And so I thought campaigning for, you know, ecological justice while getting on planes is I found it problematic at the time. I've since realised that, you know, as much as the Kropotkin that you want to read 19th century critiques of the state, while there's much to draw there, aren't as applicable, given that the biggest superpowers today aren't really states but are actually multinational corporations. And to use a Monty Python phrase, big corporations or the state isn't the messiah, but it can be useful for keeping in check very naughty boys. And big corporations in the current climate crisis that we're facing, it doesn't matter, you know, how many Priuses we drive or riding our bike or changing our light bulbs or the beauty of, you know, our permaculture gardens that we start and, you know, becoming a locavore in the way that we eat. If big corporations are still allowed to pollute at an uncapped level, we've got a chance. And so I find it fascinating, Luke, that there's so much concern about Ebola and about ISIS, and we're living through an unprecedented ecological crisis, that our grandchildren won't be dealing with those two issues, but they'll be dealing with this issue, and it goes completely unchecked. And it's just one of the things that, like, despite the fact that 98% of peer-reviewed scientists agree on this, and, you know, scientists are a conservative bunch. Scientists don't go... Bill McKibben had this comment in terms of the IPCC paper that has just come out, that them saying that their quotes around it is... Bill McKibben's take was, it's like them saying this is a zombie apocalypse with ISIS and Ebola thrown in. It's worse than that. But in the US, again, it's just one of those issues that people fear to talk about because it's, well, maybe I should leave the analysis of that to our sisters and brothers in the US.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. After hearing you talk for about 27 minutes now, it finally makes sense to me. All those pictures I see about you getting arrested and doing these protests, I completely understand now why you're getting arrested all the time. If you said this stuff in the States, you'd be arrested right away, especially in Texas.
And I guess what's really helpful is actually being able to have as our understanding of traditional Christianity grounded in orthodoxy with a little oath this time, and not in just what is the shared consensus of larger Christian commercial culture. And that's a difficult thing to do when, you know, Nicolas Cage is in a Left Behind movie and this stuff gets exported here. This is literally this kind of, like, escapist eschatology is a fear frenzy that actually provides, you know, it's not only destroy the earth, but it's all going to burn, so it doesn't matter anyway. I mean, how out of keeping is that with the actual gospel hope? What it really is a form of Gnosticism. And this stuff is so rife, and it's taken as, well, this is biblical teaching. Only if you live in a historical vacuum where you've got no understanding of how the church has traditionally held the narrative.
Mm-hmm. So say you're in that group, and say you understand Christianity as Jesus is going to save us from hell, we're going to go to heaven when we die. And that's the simple message. That's the centerpiece of what Christianity is all about. If that's the audience, what are some ways that they can start seeing these issues that you're talking about being actually part of the kingdom?
You know, and that's the interesting thing for me, Luke. For me, that's not really my audience. I mean, if I wanted to, and I was approached by Zondervan, if I wanted to sell books, making that my audience is a sure-fired winner. What you appeal to is disenfranchised evangelicals and post-fundamentalists who are looking for something more. And, you know, that's a huge market in the US. But I live in beautiful, sunny Perth, and the people who don't know Christ here, that's my context. And the beauty of the gospel in this post-Christian setting, that's really what my heart beats for. And the irony is, when I minister at places like C3 Brooklyn, that's that setting as well. There are these places in the US that are far more like our current setting, and what people long for is something that has like spiritual and intellectual integrity, and it's of course it's Bible based, but it's the scriptures found in tradition as scriptures point to Christ as the Word. And I mean, for me, it's being more captivated with the ancient power of the gospel and how it's been understood throughout the ages, and realizing that Jesus is not just good news for your soul, Jesus is good news for all of creation, for our unprecedented ecological crisis, the fact that our world spends, you know, 17 times the amount of money that we need to end absolute poverty on weapons solely designed to end human life. When our Lord says that the kingdom of God is at hand, it's literally within reach. We could reach out and touch it. And what the world waits for is for a church that is actually the church, for us Christians to take Jesus at least as seriously as like Hindus, like Gandhi, take Jesus. And what I hope, if for those that haven't switched off already, because they're listening to the like crazy Australian with what they'll probably interpret it as socialism or something like that, that the invitation to switch off Fox News, because there is something so much more beautiful. I mean, to return to the sounds of the frogs and the crickets and the goodness of God's creation, and realise that the hope is that heaven is coming here, that God's very presence will invade here, that this is still a gospel that is focused on the cross but read through the resurrection. And what nonviolence, which you'll hear me jibber-jabber about all the time, is about, is what it is to actually walk in the resurrection, mm-hmm. what it is to actually live out God's new world, that the resurrection isn't, you know, God's final rabbit out of the hat trick to prove that Jesus is the second person of the Trinity. Although, of course, Jesus is the second person of the Trinity. But what the resurrection is about is that God's new world is underway. God's cosmic cleanup plan for all of creation has actually started. And the awe and the wonder and the beauty that comes with realizing that messed up sinners like us can be a part of the transfiguration of our world, I mean, that's thrilling. And that is so much better news than the bad acting and the ridiculous plot of both Left Behind movies and theology.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the you know, this understanding of the kingdom as you're describing it is far easier to be received by your, you know, post-Christian culture that you live in?
Depends. For those who are willing to take up a cross, sure. But the gospel is still a stumbling block. Mm-hmm. I mean, that God looks like Jesus is far more threatening to most people than God looks like Zeus. And it's because, you know, to use a Freudian, our superego and a desire to project onto, in Feuerbach's understanding, project onto the divine or onto the sky, our need for structure and for discipline and for rules, that's far more comforting than a God whose power is seen at Calvary as suffering weakness, and yet that power has conquered all evil, oppression, injustice, and sin. That's the message of the resurrection, that and the ascension, which, you know, most of us in the West have just got no idea what to do with, much like the transfiguration. The ascension is that, you know, it's not about Star Trek kind of teleporting of Jesus, but that at the center of reality, Christ reigns. And so the invitation to the kingdom is not about to go someplace elsewhere, but that it's coming here and that we are invited to come under the reality and live out that reality that, that Christ truly is King.
Yeah. So how does living out that kingdom end up with pictures of you and your friends in handcuffs being arrested for, in whatever sort of nonviolent protest you guys are doing?
Yeah, and I mean, I guess the focus needs to not be on me getting arrested, but on what is actually going on before that. Some of my biggest influences, and I'm shocked as an Aussie who often looks to the US, like the US, the gift of the prophetic African American church to the world in terms of embodying. I'm startled how many Americans haven't read Howard Thurman. That when I talk about like some of my big influences that I've had the incredible privilege of spending time with, like Vincent Harding or Jim Lawson, these are legends of the freedom movement that have shaped my life and my practice. So many Americans just have blank faces until they go, "Oh, Martin Luther King worked with them." Oh, right, that. You know, that whole Ella Baker quote that Martin didn't make the movement made Martin, is lost on so many Americans who have what Cornel West would call the Santa Clausification of Martin Luther King, that despite the fact that his popularity was at an all-time low at the time when he was assassinated, yeah. America remembers a very safe Martin King, whose only challenge was actually that racism is bad, and they forget the economics and the fact that the whole reason why he was down in Memphis with these sanitation workers, what we'd say in Australia, with these garbos, with these garbage men, and not to mention his Beyond Vietnam speech in 67 at Riverside Church a year to the day before he was assassinated. To explain why we end up in the back of divvy vans or police vehicles, I'm not sure what the equivalent slang would be in the US, or in lockup, is to actually understand. Vincent Harding put it to me like this. He said, "We must remember those who went before us to remind us that we are connected." The rest of the quote is, "Part of that connection lays a great obligation on us. Part of that connection also offers us tremendous power and possibility to us." Vincent Harding actually dared us in the Love Makes a Way movement, which is challenging the indefinite detention of asylum seekers in Australia, of these refugees, that we are not merely inspired by the civil rights movement, which he would always refer to as the freedom movement, but we're actually a continuation of it. And the beauty of this tradition, much like the Anabaptist tradition in North America, I'm surprised that it's lost on so many people, because there are these gems, precious gems in the American history that look like Christ and have so much to offer the world that so many Americans often know very little about, other than a very processed and safe consumer telling of that story. Rosa Parks was just tired and had to sit down.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I've heard someone say that Dr. King actually experienced two assassinations, the first one being after his I Had a Dream speech. And so those years after that, before his assassination, we don't remember those times. But we like the peaceful, let's forgive the white people kind of guy that doesn't challenge us as much. So that's, completely true. Yeah. But there's a reason for that. I mean, it's challenging. It's hard. The escapism Christianity, which, I said the prayer, I get baptized, I go to heaven when I die, that's easily consumed. But this call to sacrifice and to, live a lifestyle of a martyr is far more redoubtable. It's overwhelming. And so if someone hears this and they say, okay, there's something to that, I want to sign up for that, I don't even know where to start, though. Like, what do you say, like, this is a place for you to start if you want to be a part of this?
The Gospels are pretty good.
they taught you well at Lipscomb that one year. Well done, Lee Camp. Well done.
That's... Stanley Hauerwas, which, you know, maybe he's the greatest thing Texas has got to offer, right? Like, what a legend.
Is Hauerwas a Texan?
Are you kidding?
Well, I know he live in, he's like Georgia now. Is he actually from Texas, though?
Oh, he's Texas all. You can't understand Hauerwas without understanding him as a Texan, being Texan.
I'm embarrassed I didn't know that.
No, you'll go back to his work now, Luke, and you'll be like, oh, my goodness, this makes sense.
You know what's funny? I had an opportunity, I think, to talk to him, and I was just, like, I was kind of scared, intimidated to talk to him, and now it makes perfect sense. He's an old Texas guy that I'm intimidated by. Perfect. Okay. Okay, so what did Hauerwas have for us?
Well, he was often, he was asked, what do you do when people ask you about Christianity? And he said, I pray the Lord's Prayer with them. Now, from America's best theologian, as Time magazine called him, even though he responded with best isn't a theological category. that is a profound answer that, I mean, and this is where the recovery of Eastern Christianity, not romanticized, like all we have to look at the church in Russia at the moment to see that, you know, Constantine is actually a saint in the East. But I'm interested in almost like an Anabaptist response to Eastern Orthodoxy. And what the East gets so right is that, you know, they reserve the term theologian to only, what, five or six people throughout history. And there's no way to talk about theology other than a subset of worship, as a subset of prayer. There's no way in the East you can imagine a theologian other than like a person of prayer, a person who has been formed and transformed by Christ. Now, the West, we talk about theology and it's so scholastic, both in Catholicism and in responses to that, that there is a desperate need for Christians to become people of prayer. I know that sounds ridiculous, but we're formed by so many other things. Where is the place for prayer? Abraham Joshua Heschel put it that the purpose of prayer is not prayer, but is God. Mm-hmm. So we've got to be careful not to put formation, because we're so desperate for formation, as the purpose of prayer. The purpose of prayer is still God, but it's in the presence of God that we are actually transformed and we receive who we really are. And so Hauerwas's response of where do we start? Read Hauerwas's theology, but start praying the Lord's Prayer. Mm-hmm. I mean, start praying. Here is Jesus's agenda summed up in relationship with God. Start there. That is one of the most profound places we can start, is in the naked, often painful place of being in silent prayer.
Yeah, that's good. Hauerwas wrote a book with, I think it was William Willimon, on the Lord's Prayer, which was just brilliant. And I think I just kind of undid your suggestion. Instead of saying theology, you said to pray. I said, well, let's read a book about prayer. So, you know, maybe I'm ignoring your suggestion. But let's talk more about, you know, becoming people of prayer. Obviously, you're someone who you've put a lot of effort. You've made a great commitment to be a kingdom-minded person. How has prayer been instrumental for you? What has it meant for you?
Yeah, I mean, I suck at it. But sucking at it is part of the journey.
That's not going to sell a book if you say I suck at prayer. Read my book. Just FYI.
Yeah, mate. There's more than one reason that like I won't have best-selling books in the US. We've worked that out. And in fact, that's part of the problem, is that our place of desire and what we place importance upon, it's so easy to learn that from a Christian consumer culture where, I mean, I'm doing some of the most beautiful and meaningful things with my life now, and some people go, such a pity that Jared ruined that opportunity with Zondervan. He could have really made it. I would not trade the goodness of what is happening in our garden and with these precious people that we have the honour to show hospitality to for any of that. But I'd be lying if I wasn't like, yeah, there are parts of me that like there's an itch to be a part of that thing. And it's in prayer that we learn new desires. It's in prayer, and actually the silence of not piling up many words, but being able to sit in the reality where our very desires become that God's name is hallowed, that God's name is made holy in a world where God's name is completely disrespected by, you know, an economy which is one of our biggest idolatries that is costing us the earth at the cost of the poor around the world. That's the reality in which we're living in, and we want fancy little, like the prayer of Jabez. To do an analysis of why that sells so well, and why, you know, preaching at one of the biggest churches in, I shouldn't mention what country, but had somebody who said to me, literally, said, this stuff you're doing on the Lord's Prayer, isn't that more of a Catholic thing? Like, if good on our Catholic sisters and brothers who have actually, like, not thrown how Jesus taught us to pray, but surely we shouldn't let them monopolize that, right? Surely the rest of us should be able to get in on that. And that says something about we have a crisis of desire. Like, we've been formed by what Dorothy Day would call the filthy, rotten system, and we just want Christianized versions of what the world offers. We want to stick a Christian bumper sticker on the back of the same agenda that is sold to us by the world. And, I mean, that means we offer the world nothing other than, you know, Bible verses taken out of context to justify an agenda which is often anti-Jesus.
Yeah, yeah, that's not going to sell a book, just FYI. That's good stuff, man. That's good.
But imagine a generation of Christian leaders who said, you know what, let's boycott that whole apparatus as the mark of what it is to be a Christian success story. So, and I mean, like your mates with BZ as well, Brian Zahn. One of the things I admire about Brian above everything else is the way that his commitment to the faithfulness of God. That was an interesting Freudian slip, a very anti-right Freudian slip. His commitment to the faithfulness of God. I'm going to run with it.
Take it.
Has meant that he has, you know, lost over 1,000 people from his church, you know, how that affects a pastor's tithes and all the rest, and is daring to draw people into a Christianity where the ancient power of the gospel is actually able to be taught and people are able to be invited in. That is beautiful, and that's why I think Brian is actually one of the most important. Sure, he's a phenomenal preacher. That's undoubtable. Sure, he's a like a brilliant thinker, mm-hmm. but he's also a person of prayer who has allowed God to get at him in such ways that he can risk taking up his cross and do that in a context where it costs him so much. That, not the books he sells, is success for me. The cross has to become our measure of success.
As I hear you talk about Christianity, especially Christianity in the West, it sounds to me like one of the big things that you see as a hangout for Christianity is the celebrity culture that gets pastors and churches caught up in that. And, you know, how many thousands of members do we have and how many books are we going to sell? And that, in its sense, domesticates the message of the gospel. Is that a fair read on your take?
As long as we don't push it too far, because it's not the opposite of that which is good news. There's nothing wrong with big churches.
There's
nothing wrong with books and all the rest. It's when that actually becomes our standard for what it is to. I would love to see our standard for success be that I find it easier to confess. I find it easier to name where I'm a part of everything that doesn't look like what God dreams for the world, where we become much more the lead pastor where I'm a pastor, I'm teaching pastor at West City Church, and our lead mm-hmm. pastor, Phil Stevenson, nearly every Sunday he says, "Welcome to Sinners Anonymous," and I love it. That's the journey, is that we give up the self-righteous games, which sometimes happen in reaction in the US. God, I thank you I'm not like those fundamentalists that I grew up with. God, I thank you like I'm not like those Tea Party Christians that I will see at my next family gathering. That's not the gospel. That's just a new pharisaicalism, only you're doing it with actually what isn't really progressive politics. It's just not the Tea Party, and that's not the hope of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, you're right.
I like it. Yeah, that is still... Anyway.
Yeah.
our measure needs to be actually... you know, it's that Thomas Merton stuff of we may never see the fruits of this, but save us from success. Be a drunkard, be a bastard, be a liar, but above all things, avoid being successful. And it's not that there's... It's about what success is defined as. And if we can hear with Philip Berrigan when he says, the poor tell us who we are, and the prophets tell us who we can be, so we hide our poor and we kill our prophets.
Mm.
It's time to include our poor and realize what it is to be poor of spirit amongst them, and to hear our prophets and let them dare us to look like the world that God longs for, that has actually started in Jesus.
Wow, that's good. Hey, you've got a lot of good stuff to say, and let me just say this for all of my Tea Party gun-carrying friends. You can send your hate messages to Jared on Twitter, and he will respond to all of them. No, this has been fun. Jared, you had a lot of good stuff to say, man.
We joke about it in the office as badly worded prayer requests when we get hate mail, and it's like, oh, a badly worded prayer request.
Oh, that's good. That's a nice attitude. That's a nice adjustment. Good for you. Well, Jared, thanks for your time, man. Blessings.
No worries, bro. And I would, in future, let's talk about Love Makes a Way in some more detail. I'd love to tell you some of the exciting stuff that's actually happening here.
We'll have to have you back again, definitely.
That'd be fun, Luke. Hey, keep God's love.
Bad blessings, that good stuff.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.